Your North Carolina Reading Service presents the following program for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. It's the Indie Week, the Independent, and it's read this week by John Federson. This issue dated May the 31st of 2024. Now, this issue is dated the 31st, and when it came out of my IndieWeek.com website, where I go for most of it, it said this is their annual food issue, and so most of the articles I'm going to read to you are food and beverage and entertainment related. Before I get to all of those, as many as I can reach anyway, I've got a couple of regular hard news and information articles to read to you, and we'll begin with one of those now. Both these articles concern Durham, and the first one by Lisa Sorg says, the lead cleanup in Durham Parks is expected to take years and cost millions. State environmental officials will conduct further tests in and near five Durham parks to determine the extent of widespread lead contamination that has disrupted summer camps, closed playgrounds, and concerned residents whose children have frequented those areas. These areas could include private property adjacent to the parks with the owner's permission. At East Durham Park on East Main, areas with lead 10 times the EPA action levels abut an apartment complex. Likewise, at Lyon Park on Lakewood Avenue, two homes sit just feet from contaminated areas. For the past year, community members and Toxic Free NC, a nonprofit environmental group, have urged Durham officials to be more transparent about the findings and to protect the public from the contamination, efforts that culminated at a public meeting Wednesday evening. Mayor Leonardo Williams said, "We know how serious it is. None of us was born when this happened, but we are responsible for cleaning it up. Over time, we've learned a lot. We are in a crisis. We will address the contamination." The source of the lead was an old municipal incinerator that operated on those sites until the 1950s. When they were dismantled. The property then became parkland. Northgate Park didn't have an incinerator, but waste was disposed there. In the early to mid-20th century, incinerators were intentionally sited in historically black and low-income neighborhoods, racist practices that continue to burden those communities with pollution. Lead is a neurotoxin. Chronic exposure can cause permanent neurological and brain damage in children who are especially vulnerable because they spend time outdoors and often put their hands in their mouths. Adults with high blood levels of lead can suffer from brain, kidney, heart, and reproductive disorders. The city consistently downplayed and early on even ignored the threat of lead in the parks. In the fall of 2021, with Parks and Rec's approval, Eniko Bihari, then a master's student at Duke University's Nicholas School of the Environment, sampled soil at three parks because of this incinerator history. As North Carolina Newsline previously reported, top Durham Parks officials knew about the likely lead contamination early as November of 2022, when Dan Richter, a soil scientist at Duke, alerted them to researchers' initial sampling results. Richter again informed parks officials about the findings in the spring, although he did not inform the public either. Not until June of 2023, after a Walltown neighborhood resident found a paper online by Duke University researchers that showed testing results, did park officials react. And even then, behind the scenes, Parks Director Wade Walcott was pressuring Toddy Steelman, dean of Duke's Nicholas School of the Environment, not to publicly disclose the data until she cleared it with the city, declined Steelman. Parks and Rec staff didn't provide a timely response, said Walcott at this week's meeting. It should never have happened that way. I deeply regret that and apologize. So here are areas closed in five Durham parks for lead testing. And some of these you may have heard me read in previous articles, but I'll do it again. Lion Park on Lakewood Avenue at the playground and ball field. Walton Park, I guess, road is a grass field, basketball court, and a playground. On North Alston, we have East End Park, playground, a shelter on the east playground, and a pergola. East Durham Park on 2500 East Main is a shelter and a playground. And Northgate Park, West Club Boulevard playgrounds, youth, tot, and swing set playgrounds. Nearly a year after the findings became public, large swaths of five parks, Walton, Northgate, East End, East Durham, and Lyon, are closed. And Durham officials have enlisted the State Department of Environmental Quality to help assess the full extent of the contamination and to possibly receive funding to clean it up, a process that will take years. The parks are now enrolled in the state's pre-regulatory landfill program, which provides local communities with technical expertise and funding to clean up contamination. A pre-regulatory landfill is defined as any land area, whether public or private, where municipal solid waste was disposed before 1983. Prior to that date, landfills were not required to be lined, and there were lax, or in some cases, non-existent regulations about how to dispose of waste. This is before 1983. The state prioritizes cleanups by using a risk score. State contractors said Wednesday they will now do further testing to determine how far the contamination extends, known as the waste boundary. They will also dig beneath the playgrounds to learn the depth of the lead and other contaminants in the soil. Since streams flow through Walltown, Northgate, and Lyon, contractors will sample them as well as groundwater and soil gas. Walcott said city officials included $5 million in the annual budget toward a short-term solution. We don't anticipate this will fix all the issues. Excuse my laughter, it's not funny. Until DEQ contractors finish fieldwork, the city won't know what a full remediation will entail or how much it will cost. Walcott said that instead of waiting, we wanted to submit some funding to help with alternatives. Now for context, $19 million in federal and state funding has been earmarked to clean up a similar site in Greensboro, Bingham Park. That park, also in a black neighborhood, had an incinerator and a landfill. It's closed during the remediation. The city also plans to pursue EPA and state grants, as well as possibly direct funding from the state legislature or Congress. Walcott said these are complex issues, and it will take a long time for a 100% fix. DEQ doesn't know the full extent of what we're up against. More from Durham now. The city of Durham's cemetery maintenance policy raises questions. When Meg Solera visited Maplewood Cemetery in March of 2020, it seemed like a nice resting place for her granddaughter, Wren, who had been stillborn on the 16th of the month. She picked out a plot and after the burial went on to visit Wren's grave weekly. Like other families with loved ones buried at Maplewood, which is one of two cemeteries owned and operated by the city of Durham, Solera and her husband, Jose, placed totems on or within a few inches of Wren's marker, heart-shaped stones in a small bowl, real and artificial flowers, a metal post with a sculpture of her avian namesake. Solera says it was just lovely. It felt like we were protecting her. Then one day this spring, the Soleras pulled through the gates for their routine visit and saw someone who seemed to be in a heated discussion with the groundskeeper. When they parked the car, they realized why. Almost all of the decorations on graves across the entire cemetery had disappeared. It was April Fool's Day, so the Solaris thought it might be some sort of ghastly prank, but when they went to the office, A staff member informed them that the sweep was city policy. Solera said it felt like losing her all over again. We always knew where to find her by looking for her little wren, so we literally could not find her. Maplewood is situated at the intersection of Chapel Hill Road and Moorhead Avenue, the Lakewood Shopping Center. On one side of Chapel Hill Road, a number of prominent Durhamites are interred in crypts, including George Watts, Bartlett Durham, and several members of the Washington Duke family. Across the street, infants are buried in a pasture lined with saplings. Solera picked out Wren's plot during the week in 2020 when almost everything except cemeteries had shut down due to COVID. Her daughter and son-in-law, Wren's parents, live in New York, but wanted Wren to be laid to rest in Durham, where Solera lives, because the alternative was to bury her at a cemetery in Long Island that the family could only visit a few times a year. So Solera donned a mask and made her way over to Maplewood, where a staff member put her in the back seat of a golf cart and drove her to a part of the cemetery where most of the grave markers only have one date. What struck Solera most about the baby section of Maplewood when she first visited was that nearly every headstone and marker she saw was decorated with flowers or mementos, saying small angels were resting on markers. There were solar lights, which are like garden stakes with little disks of light on top. It felt like somewhere where Wren wouldn't be alone. That's part of why it was so jarring to find the cemetery bereft of trinkets. Solera and her husband went to the cemetery office, and a staff member told them that items were removed from grave sites so that landscapers could abate weeds. When Solera asked why she didn't receive notice of the cleanup, the staffer told her the contract enumerates what is and is not allowed to be used as a grave decoration. Then the staff guided them to a shed where hundreds of objects taken from grave sites were piled on a table and on the floor. Solera says she doesn't recall a cleanup like this happening in the past 4 years that she's been visiting Wren. But Al Walker, a division manager for the Durham General Services Department, whose portfolio includes cemetery operations, says cleanups happen every spring and fall. Quote, on March 1, our maintenance staff conducted their regularly scheduled biannual facility cleanups, ensuring the grounds maintain a neat appearance while also removing hazards for maintenance staff, since the mowing season begins in mid-March. Walker wrote in an email to Indy, as part of their routine, they remove old and non-compliant decorations, glass items, rocks, borders, windmills, etc. Only one flower vase and one arrangement are permitted on a grave marker, he added. Solera says she agrees that breakable items should be prohibited and also appreciates the commitment to landscaping. But the stringency of the regulations raise some questions for her, particularly the bar on rocks, given the Jewish tradition of placing stones on graves. Solera says it feels like Durham doesn't care about protecting the sanctity of gravesites. By taking away everything that was watching over her, they desecrated her plot. Mostly, Solera says she wishes the city would have given her notice ahead of time. I might not have liked it, but at least I would be prepared for it, she says. And as a parenthesis, after Indy reached out to cemetery management with a request for comment, a note about an annual spring cleanup was added to the management webpage, requesting that lot owners remove any non-spring seasonal decorations or items not compliant before March 1. Now, a bereavement counselor at Duke Integrative Medicine, Marissa Holston, says for people to go to the cemetery to visit their loved ones in a space that's highly charged with memories and emotions and see what they've created to memorialize a person has been taken away, it's quite traumatic. It has a lot of psychological and emotional harm. Holston goes on saying, decorating grave markers or building memorials at places where loved ones have passed is a common and, quote, healthy coping mechanism for people to process their grief. She says she's never heard of this happening at a cemetery before. She even did some digging after hearing about what happened at Maplewood, Holston says, and could only find anecdotes of people who had been given notice of coming cleanups so they could move their ornaments to a safe place and return them after landscaping was completed. That's the only method that makes sense. Holston says a risk of Durham's current approach is it could lead plot owners to form negative associations with a sacred space. Distrust, fear, a lack of safety, those are feelings you absolutely do not want linked with the experience of trying to honor or memorialize your loved one. That's what Solera is dealing with. The staff member who led her to the shed of items told her she was allowed to restore the flowers and Wren sculpture to the grave, so she has put those back. And she started to place the heart-shaped stones directly on top of the marker instead of collecting them in a bowl. But she feels anxious when she approaches the cemetery now. This isn't the mindset I want to be in when I come here. I just want to feel the love I have for Wren and her spirit. Now, I will save this for a couple of weeks before I had a chance to read it, and this is the time. It's an op-ed by Pierce Freelon, who is up to recently a former Durham City Council member, a musician, educator, author, and he writes about the School of the Arts. Before downtown Durham's 21st century renaissance, it was home to a crumbling tobacco industry. Then in 1995, two catalysts planted seeds for a radical transformation, the openings of the Durham Bulls Athletic Park and Durham School of the Arts, then called the Durham Magnet Center. These two events radically shifted Durham's trajectory and contributed to a culture of innovation, tech, health, education, investment, entrepreneurship, and arts that downtown Durham is known for today. I was 12 years old in 1995 and lived a few blocks from campus. My parents entered me and my sister into the lottery for Durham School of the Arts, the DSA, and we both got in, becoming part of the first class of students at the new school. DSA was the perfect fit for me. I was able to explore my artistic strengths in the music and theater department and quickly made friends with a variety of students and faculty from different socioeconomic and cultural backgrounds. Because of the school's location, we could feel the pulse of downtown Durham. We were part of it. I could taste pollen mixed with curing tobacco in the air as I walked to school a few blocks away from downtown's aging warehouses. I could hear the call of the train's whistle and the faint pop of post-game fireworks ricochet off red clay bricks from the Bulls Athletic Park on game days. The School of the Arts sits at the nexus of several neighborhoods that felt both stitched together and separated like sections of a quilt. The hem between the affluent, predominantly white Forest Hills community and neighboring Southside St. Teresa Hood, which is historically black and increasingly Latino, frayed at the Forest Hills Shopping Center, where I worked my first job at Eckerd Drugstore. Predominantly white Trinity Park, which borders DSA's campus, was next to historically black Walltown and Old North Durham, and just a block from Duke's East Campus and 9th Street. DSA's location defines its culture. The student body reflects the rich diversity of its surroundings. We tried on the sleeves of downtown Durham before it was cool, and in turn we impacted its design. We were raised by a community that was ethnically, economically, and culturally diverse. And in turn, we poured magic back into the community. Do you know who the performers are in those venues around downtown Durham? Who's putting art up in our galleries? Who's painting our murals? Who's cooking our delicious food? Who's leading our Dia de los Muertos celebrations? Who are rappers, poets, and beat makers? Who is shaping the culture of downtown Durham? It's alumni of the Durham School of the Arts. There are no million-dollar condos and billions of dollars investment in downtown without the culture that the Bulldogs have shaped. There's no vibrant creative class and diverse entrepreneurial and cultural hub without the presence of hundreds of young, diverse artists at downtown's doorstep. Durham School of the Arts has played a vital role in the growth, economic development, diversity, character, and the culture of downtown Durham. To take DSA out of downtown would be as foolish as taking DPAC, the Durham Bulls, or the Durham Hotel out of downtown. Now, more than ever, we need diverse, young creatives to flood the streets of downtown, which are becoming more white and more wealthy due to gentrification. Don't exacerbate the erasure or black and brown youth from downtown by moving the school. Invest in the downtown culture and creativity by investing in keeping DSA where it's at. Pierce Freelon. Now, off in the autumn coming into Durham, is the Hopscotch Festival, and that is, I believe it's over in Raleigh, downtown Raleigh. It's not till September, and there is an article on IndieWeek.com which gives a lineup for the entire festival, which is between September 5 and 7 in Raleigh, North Carolina. And they give a little snippets for all the entertainers who have been booked already to appear there. I'm going to hold that in abeyance and save it till later on in the year. However, if one were to go to IndieWeek.com, one could find that lineup or the schedule there, or just do an internet search for Hopscotch Festival, and I'll bet you'll find all those things. It's September 5th through 7th, 2024. And now, you've heard all that word about food, delicious food. Let's read some articles about food, please. The first article about Preeti Wass, W-A-A-S, written by Leila Khoury-Hanold, is about the restaurant and Chini, C-H-E-E-N-I. I happen to know about the Chini restaurant in Raleigh, which just recently closed. I've eaten there a few times. And this is a very celebrated space for Indian cuisine. When Preeti Wass first introduced herself to me, writes Leila Khoury-Hanold, at a hospitality industry event in November of 2019, she said, "I brought you something," and pressed a silver thermos into my hands. I unscrewed the lid, and a current of steamy chai wafted upward, redolent of ginger, cardamom, and fennel. I took a sip, and the hot, velvety tea slid down my throat like liquid comfort. It remains one of the most touching gestures I've received as a food writer, but it's exemplary of the thoughtful, personal touches that Wass extends to diners at Chini, or Chennai, too. Now in the heels of closing that North Raleigh relocation, Wass is going all in on Chennai Durham with her most personal menu to date and an expanded vision for community cooking classes, collaborations, and pop-ups. On May 17th, Wass also opened the Bar Beej, B-E-E-J, a semi-secret speakeasy within Chennai Durham, In Sanskrit, there is the Beej mantra, she says, a very powerful mantra that speaks to the divine feminine. She speaks reverently about India's origin as a matriarchal society, one at odds with a societal framework for women she grew up in, a culture where you're dried up after 40. She describes operating Chennai as bonus life past 50. Prior to meeting Wass back in 2019, I knew of her through her superlative chocolate chip cookies and juicy jams. A friend had gifted me samples from Sugar and Spice Kitchen and Jolly Good Jams, Wass's small batch food companies. That fall, she had just opened Chennai, an Indian tea and snack shop in the lobby of Raleigh's Poynter YMCA. The venture's success propelled her to take another leap forward, and in 2021, she opened Chennai Indian Food Emporium in the North Raleigh Shopping Center. To honor her dream of teaching cooking classes, she had to become a full-fledged restaurant to obtain the proper permits. So in addition to serving pastries and chai, she added a counter-service menu: rice bowls and kebab rolls by day, lamb vindaloo and Bengali roast chicken by night. Opening a restaurant led to one of Wasa's biggest surprises, being nominated as a James Beard Award semifinalist for Best Chef of the Southeast in 23 and 24. The first nomination led to an influx of diners, but with high rent and a no-tipping model that starts all the staff at a pay rate of $16 an hour, that boon did not translate into more profit. Focusing on her fledgling restaurant operation precluded her from allocating time and resources to cooking classes and guest chef pop-ups. So when the opportunity came along in November 23 to open Chennai Durham in the former Jack Tar space in downtown, her time became even further divided. Once she got Chennai Durham up and running, she planned to return Chennai Indian Food Emporium to its original vision. That's a community space and marketplace for classes, events, pop-ups, and grab-and-go goods. But in mid-April, she received an unexpected call from her landlord detailing plans to sell the shopping center to an out-of-state entity. This, Wasa says, meant the community aspect of the location, which is what appealed to me when I signed the lease, was no longer the case. She adds that high rent and high operating costs without sales to sustain them don't work, especially when an impersonal entity owns the building. And on April 20th, she closed Chennai Indian Food Emporium for good. Classes and events scheduled prior to the closure will be honored, though, at Chennai Durham, including a pop-up that morphed into a Mother's Day brunch collaboration with Madre executive chef Louise Zwang. Chennai Durham is closed on Wednesdays and closed on Sundays after brunch. So during those times, Wasa envisions hosting cooking classes devoted to making chai, chutneys, and chaats, samosas, and pakoras. She also plans to do pop-up with guests like Lauren Markowitz and Alex Fiacci, formerly of Amano in Syracuse, New York. That's slated for this June. And Lord Fur Lalicon, the chef at Filipino restaurant Kaya, his James Beard Award finalist based in Orlando, Florida. So Wasa says of creating her current spring and summer menu, "I feel like I've come into my own, and I'm realizing what my own meant. I now know what's possible, what I'm capable of. I'm able to take homemade basic food and make it look appealing on the plate, and the flavors are fresh and true to me, not fussy at all, but I still make it look like refined dining. That's what I call Chennai Durham." Honoring her preferred flavor profiles, funk, acidity, balanced spice, while also meeting diners' expectations, has been a delicate balancing act for Wasa. Servers at Chennai Durham wear buttons that say, "Ask me about anything except chicken tikka masala." But Wasa has found a workaround of sorts. Saufwala chicken, the one dish her mother taught her to make, features tender chicken thighs cooked with fennel seeds, onions, and green chilies, plus Wasa's addition of tomatoes, and finished with whipped yogurt. She says it's bright, acidic, and not a creamy dish where it has cream, which is what people think of when they think of tikka masala. "We don't cook like that in India, or eat like that in India, at least not how I grew up." She was born and raised in the south of India, but she identifies with her Punjabi heritage. After the partition of India and Pakistan, Wasa's father moved from northern India to the state of Tamil Nadu on the southeast coastline. She says, "We lived like Punjabis at home, so we ate like Punjabis every day." For Wasa and her siblings, a typical Punjabi lunch consisted of a whole wheat roll, unleavened flatbread served with dal, lentils, and accompaniments such as raita, a yogurt vegetable sauce, and sabzis, vegetable sides. She pays homage to these Punjabi roots with tamatar and bindi dal tadka, slow-cooked split chickpea lentils with tomatoes and okra, tempered with ghee, clarified butter, and panch paran, a five-spice blend of black mustard, cumin, fennel, nigella, and fenugreek seeds. I have to confess, I don't know nigella. It's a seed blend that combines north, south, east, and west so well, it symbolizes India to me. Her expansive view of Indian cuisine is reflected on her menu, which draws inspiration from culinary traditions all across the country. On the printed menu, you'll find outlines of various states, denoting a dish's specialized origins, or speculated origins, alongside anecdotes of her connections to and riffs on each dish. Growing up in a coastal town fostered her love of seafood and an appreciation for both coasts' preparation styles. One of her Wasa's favorite creations is fish moili, which highlights a Keralan coconut curry sauce. She bucked tradition, though, by blending the sauce, and was delighted to discover it further concentrated the flavors of the ingredients, including garlic, ginger, and chiles. Mild, buttery barramundi is marinated in lemon juice, turmeric, and salt, then seared skin side down for a contrasting crisp. Two pieces are arranged skin side up in an oval bowl, briefly luxuriating in the silky, bright yellow coconut sauce before being anointed with a verdant green curry leaf oil. She says, "I love it so much. I have chefs clamoring for this dish. It's a dish that makes people want to lick their fingers." Happily, it's served with flaky, crispy Malabar parathas to mop up this luscious sauce. Another Kerala-inspired favorite are the mutakos medallions, inspired by vegetable porial, described on Chennai's menu as a simple, tasty accompaniment to many meals, often prepared with freshly grated coconut, tempered curry leaves, and mustard seeds. Wasa's interpretation makes fresh cabbage the main event by cutting it into steaks, which are then brined and braised until silky. Then the medallions are charred on a flat top, plated atop a lime pickle-spiked yogurt sauce, and finished with a tarka, a fresh ginger, green chili, and black mustard seeds, tempered in oil. Wasa says of her evolution as a chef, "It's not me just opening a restaurant of Indian origin and say I'm going to sell India food. This is a journey for me. It's a journey of saying I'm exploring what it means to be me through my food." Well, that's Chennai Durham. How about a Raleigh food truck serving up Pueblan dishes with care? If you had tried to seek out, writes Gabby Mendick, had you tried to seek out Pueblan food in the area a few years ago, you would have come up short. While local Mexican fare is widely available around the Triangle, regional food is still somewhat limited. Case in point, despite the number of Mexican restaurants, groceries, and food trucks in the area until recently, none offered regional Pueblan fare. That changed in 2021 when the Vega family, Luis Miguel, his wife Angeles, and their children, Luis Vasquez, Edwin Vasquez, and Jose, or J-O-U-S-E, opened Que Chula Es Puebla. The truck showcases matriarch Angeles' traditional cooking from her hometown of Puebla, which is the capital city of the Mexican state of Puebla that holds the same name. Que Chula Es Puebla can be found parked at 2601 South Saunders Street in Raleigh, next to a Mexican market and a Boost mobile store. Wrapped in photos of featured dishes and images of Pico de Orizaba, which is a volcano in Puebla, the colorful truck is open Monday through Saturday. Luis Vasquez says, "We used to go all the way to New York to buy semitas, he recounts customers saying regarding that business presence in Raleigh, now we have them like 20 or 30 minutes away, not 8 or 9 hours. He goes on, I honestly have a lot of plates you won't see at other food trucks. He's talking about the huitlacoche quesadillas. Those are handmade corn tortillas with quesillo, cheese from Oaxaca, chicharron, and huitlacoche, or corn smut. Huitlacoche, a dark fungus that grows on the ears of corn, may not sound or look appealing to the untrained eye, but it has an earthy, intense umami flavor, quite unlike anything else. Pueblo is located about 2 hours southeast of Mexico City. Its origins as a state go back to the 16th century, when Spanish colonizers established the city along the trade route between Mexico City and Veracruz. This has shaped the region's cuisine, with ingredients brought from Europe and products like olive oil, wheat, and almonds incorporated into dishes that are now considered quintessentially Pueblan. 3 decades later, Mexico's defeat of the invading French army at Puebla in 1862 became a key event in the state's and country's history, a day now marked by the familiar festival Cinco de Mayo. Luis Vasquez says, we are the closest taste you can have to Pueblan food in the United States in this area. Everything is different. You won't ever have that same taste, but we come close to it. His parents came to the U.S. from Puebla in their late teens. Before embarking on this joint venture, Luis Miguel worked in construction, and Angeles owned and operated a cleaning business. Angeles had always cooked Pueblan dishes at home, but never dreamed of opening a food business, Luis Vasquez says, but several years ago he encouraged her to share her cooking with a bigger audience. He explains, I know the cooking's really good. I'm not just saying that because she's my mom. I wouldn't give her the idea it wasn't good. So we went ahead and did it. The entire Vega family works at Quechula, each contributing to various aspects of the kitchen and business. Luis Vasquez and Edwin are currently studying to become HVAC technician and a barber, respectively, and the truck schedule is coordinated around respective responsibilities. All hands are on deck in this family pursuit, easing the stress of owning and operating a business with the many unexpected hurdles of running a food service operation. Inflation has been one such hurdle. Customers expect food truck menus to be cheap, irrespective of the economy. But while the initial cost of opening a truck is small in comparison to a brick-and-mortar restaurant, day-to-day costs still make for slim profit margins. Luis Vasquez notes that the steadily rising costs of ingredients make cheap eats less feasible at Quechula. The semita, which can easily feed two, will cost you $17, and a plate of 3 memelas comes in at $15. Once customers try the menu, he says, they are usually on board, recognizing the high quality and value of the dishes. One of the dishes not to be missed are the tacos árabes, the Arab tacos. The origins are often traced to the early 20th century, when there were waves of immigration from Syria and Lebanon to various regions of Mexico, including Puebla. This taco, a fusion disc with both Mexican and Middle Eastern influences, has become a Pueblan staple. Marinated pork filling, traditionally cooked on a spit, similar to shawarma. Unlike more familiar street tacos that are served in corn, these are served in a slightly thicker and chewier flour tortilla called pan árabe, which has some resemblance to lafa. That's a flat bread traditionally used for shawarma. Luis Vasquez recounts, nobody really knows why they're called Arabic tacos. I want to know. I want to find out. I went to Pueblo and I started asking around. They gave me theories, but nobody really knows why. Another popular Pueblan dish the family serves is the semita, C-E-M-I-T-A. at Kichula the bread for this monstrosity of a sandwich, baked fresh every morning, is perfect canvas for the fillings. Semitas are served with a choice of chicken or beef milanesa, a breaded fried cutlet, which is piled high with thick shreds of quesillo, avocado, and your choice of papas fritas or chipotle chiles. The crispy fried meat, stretchy cheese, creamy avocado, and sweet spicy chilies balance out each bite. The memelas poblanos served at Quechula are another classic. Handmade corn tortillas stuffed with beans and topped with quesillo, salsa, onions, and meat. Luis Vasquez notes that though it isn't traditional, he grew up eating memelas with sour cream, and he continues to snack on them this way. So fusion foods and modern takes on traditional dishes are sometimes intentionally invented by conceptual chefs. But just as often, these evolutions and creations occur accidentally as people and the foods they bring with them migrate to new places. Whether tacos árabes on Pueblan street corners or memelas topped with sour cream, foods evolved, telling the stories of where their creators came from. Driving down Saunders Street, Quechula es Puebla might look like any other taco truck, but looks can be deceiving. This food truck's attention to detail and commitment to creating authentic Pueblan dishes, with dishes made entirely from scratch, make this family-run food truck a unique destination worth seeking out. Okay, still in Raleigh. Nation Han has written about Ponysaurus Brewing. Jeff Sizer spent much of his career in fine dining, but his first culinary idols were the cooks at the pizza shop in his childhood Brooklyn neighborhood. They were like the coolest dudes in the world, he recounts. The shop had this old-school Italian vibe. Everybody knows the pizza guys. They drove cool cars, and I looked up to those guys growing up. It's fitting, then, that Sizer now helms the pizza kitchen for Ponysaurus Brewing at the company's recently opened Raleigh Ironworks space, its third location. Leading a pizza kitchen, he says, is the culmination of a 22-year-long dream. Sizer, S-E-I-Z-E-R, has spent his entire career in kitchens, beginning with cooking school at age 18. His first kitchen job was at Montrachet, the illustrious French restaurant in New York City that closed in the early 2000s. He was part of a 6-person intern class and the only intern to last the summer. He remembers laughing, "All I did at that job for 6 months was make blinis with caviar. I just stood there with a little hot plate and flipped blinis." From there, Sizer moved on to Union Square Cafe, where he began as a line cook before assuming the role of sous chef. Union Square brought him fully into the hospitality company of legendary restaurateur and chef Danny Meyer. Sizer went on to join Maelino's opening team, eventually serving as the chef de cuisine of the Gramercy Park Hotel restaurant. While leading the kitchen there, he cooked for the likes of Keith Richards, Mick Jagger, and Questlove. He says of this fine dining experience, "I'm this little kid from Brooklyn. I'm earning nothing, working my butt off, and I'm doing dinner for Questlove." Sizer cites Union Square's Cafe Carmen Quagliata as one of his most important mentors. He points to Quagliata's vision of putting beautiful ingredients on the plate without overly complicating them as a key lesson in his own evolution as a chef, describing that ethos as cooking with Italian sensibilities in terms of believing that olive oil, garlic, roasting, and caramelization can drive a beautiful dish forward. "You let time and heat do the work," he says. "You develop the natural flavors." Nation Han says, "I first met Sizer when he was guiding the kitchen at the now-closed Royale in downtown Raleigh. He moved to the Triangle with his then-wife to be closer to family. Royale, offered a blend of French and American fare, including a much-loved burger that arrived on a locally made English muffin with Gruyere cheese and Royale sauce, fried duck wings made a la orange, and moule frites. Some of my fondest memories of Royale's food came when Jeff would offer one-night tasting menus. On several occasions, these menus were built around red sauce Italian fare, and you could see his love for his grandmother's cooking shine through. Even then, he would hint that an Italian restaurant might be in his future. Royale, like many restaurants, fell victim to COVID, and Seitzer found his way to the Counting House restaurant in Durham's Museum Hotel. He breathed a new life into the menu there with, among others, a Royale burger and an array of pasta that often stole the show. Well, shortly after he moved to Durham, Seitzer befriended Nick Hawthorne Johnson, one of the owners of the Pony Saurus Brewing. They stayed in touch over the years, and one day Hawthorne Johnson texted Seitzer and asked him to chat. After learning that Hawthorne Johnson's next project would be based in Raleigh under the Pony Saurus brand, and that in this role Seitzer would work with Anthony Guerra of Oakwood Pizza Box, and that Seitzer's partner in both life and the kitchen, Roxy Garza, could join him in the kitchen, it was an easy yes for Seitzer. So Pony Saurus launched as a Durham pop-up in the years before it became a full-fledged brewery in 2015. The brand felt creative from the start. From the Pony Meets Dinosaur logo to the slogan, "The best beer would drink, the best, the beer would drink if beer drank beer." That was a tongue twister. The brand has showcased its creativity as if it had been made to both delight and reflect the community in which it was built and brewed. I caught up with Hawthorne Johnson recently about Pony Saurus expansion from Durham to Wilmington and now Raleigh. Hawthorne Johnson said it ultimately came down to allowing Pony Saurus to do what it does best in more places. "We do two things," he says. "We make beer, and we hold space for people to gather together and build their community in our space, opening some more locations where people can get together and where we can provide space for people to enjoy our beers and share in fellowship together," was exciting. Over the past 2 years, the Pony Saurus team evaluated markets across North Carolina before settling on Wilmington and Raleigh. Both of the new locations have opened within the last 4 months. Hawthorne Johnson says, "With Raleigh, it came down to the fact we have amazing friends doing really amazing things in the food and beverage space. We wanted to come and add to the scene here and participate in all that's happening." The location's proximity to the original brewery in Durham will also allow Pony Saurus production team to dive into making sours and barrel aging at the Raleigh facilities, while remaining close to their main brewing facility. The proximity also means that many Raleigh customers have already visited the brewery in Durham. "This comes with a certain amount of pressure," Hawthorne Johnson adds. "It's scary to open something that's so close to our original location. Pretty much everybody here knows who we are and what we're doing in Durham. We're going to have a certain set of expectations." Over the past several months, Seitzer, Garza, and their team have worked to breathe life into the Raleigh location's menu. The pizza is built around the sauce and dough that Guerra and Oakwood Pizza Box have perfected. Seitzer and his team wanted to lean into good, humble food that reflects both the flavors Seitzer grew up loving and the seasonal bounty of the nearby farmer's market. On the current menu, you'll find a clam pizza, inspired by Seitzer's love for Frank Pepe Pizzeria in New Haven, Connecticut. It's built on a white sauce base, and the chopped clams taste fresh and swim in garlic, lemon, and parsley. You'll notice just a little spiciness in the zest, and you'll definitely want more than one slice. You'll also find a blistered tomato pizza that has, over repeat visits, become one of my favorites. Wings that Seitzer says are cooked with minimal ingredients, including a little brown butter and sugar, a burger made with La Frida beef and aged cheddar, and several salads, and of course, a pepperoni pizza, because as Sicer notes, pepperoni and pilsners go super well together. Ultimately, pizza will remain core to the menu, even as the team works on varied options to go alongside it. Pizza and beer, Sicer says, are natural friends. And now, another article by Nation Han about Scott Crawford. The sun is beaming into Brodetto's dining room a few hours before service begins, and I'm sitting with Chef Scott Crawford discussing the evolution of his vision for his restaurant group over Cafe Americanos. He's reflecting on the early months of the COVID pandemic. He says, I almost immediately went to a dark place in my mind because that's what addicts do, right? He says. My career's over. Our restaurants are shut down. People are dying. It's a dark time for everyone. But mentally, I knew that I was in trouble. Crawford acknowledges his thinking shifted as time passed, but for his own mental health at the time, he had to find a way to embrace his creativity and work ethic in an effort to find a new path forward. The pandemic upended the entire restaurant industry, and the changes persisted even as the pandemic receded. The increased adoption of working from home has reshaped how some restaurants approach lunch, even if they open for it at all. Countless restaurants have closed or transitioned to other models, such as food trucks. Against this background, Crawford Hospitality stands out as one of the most ambitious restaurant groups in the Triangle, with Brodetto's recent opening at the Raleigh Iron Works and the group's new cocktail bar, Sue Terra, which opened in mid-May. Crawford Genuine will soon open at Raleigh-Durham International Airport and Crawford Brothers Steakhouse, initially announced in 2018, has a planned opening for later this year. Still, all of this growth began in a dark place. Throughout his years in recovery, Crawford says he realized he has to have a continual focus on mental health in order to remain strong for himself and his family and to serve as a good leader for his company. To step out of the dark place, he knew that he had to get to work. During the pandemic, his neighborhood restaurant, Crawford & Sons, began offering takeout. The French Bistro Jolie offered a variety of creative activations, including a champagne window, and the community support of both concepts gave Crawford hope. He says, I started planning. I started saying, I know this is going to change, this is going to end, and asking what I'll do then. When he left his restaurants each day, he kept his mind busy imagining what other concepts he might launch. Serendipitously, his phone began to ring as talented service industry professionals who worked for some of the top hospitality companies in the country realized they could move to a market like Raleigh for a lifestyle change. Between the concepts Crawford spent his evenings drawing up, the talent that his team was adding, and the pandemic receding with the rollout of vaccinations, the Crawford Hospitality team was ready to make those dreams a reality. Brodetto is the first of the new restaurants to come to life. When visitors step inside this restaurant, they find the bright, airy space that takes inspiration from the Crawford family's travels to the Croatian and Italian coasts along the Adriatic Sea. The bar resembles the salt blocks they discovered in markets at the Italian coastal villages they toured, and is backlit to suggest the feel of the sea. A lattice-like wall next to the host stand draws inspiration from the fences surrounding the backyards of residences in the towns Crawford and his family walked through. Along the wall is a Thomas Sayer-designed piece that represents the Adriatic coastlines. The food at Brodetto similarly represents a unique fusion of the flavors and approaches Crawford discovered on his first visit to Croatia. The team have found ways to fuse the dishes and approaches he saw on his travels with North Carolina ingredients. The restaurant's name is an homage to Brodetto, what locals call the fish stews found along the Adriatic coast. The base concept for any progetto is use a wide array of fish, and at Crawford's you'll find monkfish, prawns, and octopus, but also wild mussels and clams harvested along the coast of North Carolina by a purveyor that Scott knows. Several other offerings tap into this combination of familiar dishes, nostalgia, and coastal influences. The spaghetti al nero, little gem hearts and agliotti, were some of my favorites during my first two visits. The sea urchin butter and chili pangrattato in the spaghetti dish provide a nice touch of heat and richness. The ramp Caesar in the little gem hearts brings a delightful punch to an old favorite, and the agnolotti combines the pasta's typical light, pillowy texture with sweet peas and lemon zest. Along the Person Street corridor, 2 miles south of Raleigh's Ironworks, where Crawford launched Crawford Hospitality, you'll find Sous Terre. Crawford and his longtime mixologist, Jordan Joseph, evaluated various locations around town for a potential home for a bar that would focus on classic cocktails and high-quality hospitality. The answer ultimately arrived just down a flight of stairs from Jolie when the Atlantic Lounge owner, Jason Howard, called Crawford and offered him the chance to take over the space. Crawford and Joseph jumped at the opportunity to build a cocktail bar in a neighborhood that feels like home to them both. I'm struck by the bar's clean lines and warm wood. The space still has a cozy neighborhood bar vibe of the Atlantic Lounge, but it is brighter and lighter. The overhaul began in January and was a true family effort for all involved. Crawford and his wife worked on design elements, while Joseph's stepdad and brother and a family friend cleared the place and led much of the remodeling, down to laying the tile. "We want a particular feel here," says Joseph. "We keep coming back to the word cozy. We want this to be a place where you can kind of get lost in." "We want it to feel like a warm hug," says Crawford, of the way he wants guests to experience Sous Terre. "And a warm hug is about all I have time left to offer over our radio frequencies. To all of you who have listened to Indie Week this week, John Feddersen will bid you fond adieu. Hopefully there'll be we'll have a variety of articles again next week from the Indie Week, the Independent, and it is available, this broadcast, after the Friday broadcast in our podcast section at ncreadingservice.org. Thanks very much for listening to Indie Week. Back with you soon.